histories of emotion in public health seminar series.
Right. Yeah, great. Well, thank you all very much for coming, and especially to Hannah for inviting me. This paper kind of represents the first iteration of my thinking through some of the history of some of the ways in which the histories of emotions have impacted the history that I'm studying. So I really would welcome the Q&A session of this part, but it does also mean I'm going to have to read, so I apologise for that in advance. So the history of HIV/AIDS is fraught with emotions. Archival sources, oral history interviews, and personal conversations about the epidemic almost always have an emotional undertone. If we take, for example, perhaps the two most well-known cultural events during the history of HIV/AIDS in Britain, the government's Don't Die of Ignorance campaign of adverts in 1986-87, and Princess Diana's handshake at the Middlesex Hospital in the latter of those 2 years, 87. These, I would say, are the events I most commonly hear about when discussing the virus, both with interviewees, but also with family, friends, and perfect strangers. And in part, their memorability and their notoriety stems from their deeply emotional nature. Specifically, fear sits at the heart of both. When John Hurt's voice broadcast into living rooms across the nation, alerting viewers and listeners to a danger that has become a threat to us all, there's a deadly disease and there is no known cure, the desired result was a shift in public awareness of HIV motivated by fear. The significance of Diana shaking gloveless hands with the first patients on the Middlesex's new AIDS ward, the first of its kind in Britain, acts as a cipher for the culture of fear which existed around the notion of tactile contact with people with HIV before that. That the history of emotions should be used to explore the history of HIV/AIDS then is unsurprising, I think, for two reasons. First, the subject is naturally a highly emotive one. By definition, studies of any kind which look at the virus are dealing with issues of morbidity and of mortality, both of which evoke deeply emotional responses. The second, though, is that the history of emotions has already proved a productive methodology for historians of HIV/AIDS to employ. Deborah Gould's book, Moving Politics, sought to explain the role of emotion and feeling in shaping and changing the political agenda and possibilities, what she calls the political horizon, of groups that were involved in agitating around the epidemic. Gold's broader work has put the history of emotions firmly in the arsenal of historians and sociologists working on the history of HIV/AIDS activism. And this work was especially pertinent for her. She had been a member of ACT UP Chicago, but her call for scholars to engage reflexively on our own emotional relationship with our sources, what she says, what to do when your data make you cry, is just as compelling for those of us on the other side of this generational and experiential divide. More recently, of course, Matt Cook has made a similar intervention in the historiography on the virus's impact in Britain. His article Archives of Feeling, which draws from the work of Anne Chekhovich, calls on historians of the epidemic in Britain to take emotions seriously as tools to understand moments of crisis. In his article, Cook works through a huge swathe of responses to mass observation directives on HIV/AIDS, as well as correspondence with the National Lesbian and Gay Survey, amongst others. And he does this, in doing this, he is demonstrating the complex emotional terrain of archives which speak to the HIV/AIDS epidemic. But with a few exceptions, these were all archival sources which were, to some degree, private. Anonymous contributions to social surveys, expressions of emotion, which, whilst publicly accessible to the historian through the archive, have always been held within their institutional bounds. In this paper, I want to draw attention to the history of emotions which govern some of the more public sources of the epidemic. Through discussion of a couple of AIDS objects, as well as a semi-public religious, in quote marks, ceremony, I'm going to suggest not only that HIV/AIDS is a history imbued with emotions, but that where those emotions were displayed and how they were displayed mattered politically to the activists that I'm going to talk about today. Now, what activism is, especially how we go about defining AIDS activism, is not a simple task. A number of conferences over the summer have resulted in ongoing conversations about what exactly it is we mean by activism, and AIDS activism in particular. It's clear, perhaps, this is something distinctive about the sorts of organised responses to AIDS. So in 1991, the Department of Health funded a review of the closure of the group Frontliners, which had ceased operations that year, 5 years after being founded in 1986. Frontliners had been founded, quote, to provide support for people with AIDS by people with AIDS, and was described by one of their former members as the first PWA coalition. PWA stands for Person with AIDS, or People with AIDS. The review's authors noted that, quote, many people working with or for AIDS organisations argue that these organisations are different from other voluntary organisations, being subject to very distinctive problems. Whilst the authors did note a number of factors which AIDS groups held in common with other health organisations, notably their self-help structure, coping with the implications of disability and illness, alongside similarities in the kind of bureaucratic structures that existed amongst them, they agreed that several factors marked AIDS groups out as distinctive. More than half of the reasons they gave for the distinctiveness of HIV/AIDS groups were, implicitly or explicitly, emotional. The first five reasons, as we can see here, for example, were that many of the people involved will have suffered multiple bereavements in a short space of time. Many of the people involved will have a realistic expectation of further bereavements and possibly their own death to face. It is likely that some of the people involved will have had or will be having sexual relationships with each other. Organisations and individuals are vulnerable to adverse press and public opinion. And finally, in this list, there is stigma attached to the illness. So I've suggested, and the bits that are not in italics are the direct quote from that report. And I've suggested in the italics a few of the emotions which are chiefly at play within these characteristic emotional traits. And as you can see, I'm suggesting that anger is among the most common. And indeed, it would not be controversial to suggest, I think, that anger as an emotion anchors a great deal of activism, especially that surrounding the epidemic. The well-known chant of the international chapters of the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, ACT UP, which was Fight Back, Fight AIDS, ACT UP, is purposely reminiscent of a call to arms, a plea for people to fight the epidemic, which conjures up feelings of anger. Anger was a key factor in anchoring AIDS activists' retrospective understanding of their political engagement with the virus. When the oral historian Wendy Rickard asked John Campbell what ACT UP London was about when she interviewed him in 1996, he replied, "It was about direct action, about going onto the streets and shouting very loudly and chaining yourself to whatever you could chain yourself to, kicking and screaming and everything to try and get people to take notice of AIDS." Here we can see writ large that the central activist method, for Campbell at least, was a loud and very public demonstration of anger. Emotions then were part and parcel of AIDS activism. This paper is going to explore the public expressions and demonstrations of emotions, considering the subtle political purposes they may have had. So let's start with the material culture of emotion, which was produced by religious HIV/AIDS groups. In recent years, one of the most productive areas of exploration for religious scholars has been the field of material religion. Alana Harris at King's London has observed the, quote, "trends in the study of lived religion, which stress the importance of image and materiality as a fruitful basis for studying modern religious belief." Whilst Timothy William Jones and Lucinda Matthews-Jones's book Material Religion in Modern Britain demonstrated the importance of being attentive to how religious objects were made and used, and how they functioned to shape, sustain, and reproduce belief. The HIV/AIDS epidemic in Britain provides an opportunity to further pursue the agenda of material religion scholarship, questioning the objects produced by religious individuals and communities in times of crisis and of grief, and how cultures of emotion shaped these materials. Perhaps the best known of these AIDS objects is the NAMES Project AIDS Memorial Quilt. Conceived of in 1985 by the San Franciscan activist Cleve Jones, by 1988, the nearly 8,300 quilt panels memorialising individuals who had died of HIV/AIDS-related illnesses were displayed outside the White House. Panels and quilts were produced across the world, including in Britain. These quilts would be displayed in varying quantities at events such as international conferences on HIV/AIDS and a huge number of other memorialising events and ceremonies. The production of individual panels which memorialised a person who had died from an AIDS-related illness was a deeply emotional process, made, as they inevitably were, by family, friends, lovers, etc. Thanks to Rickard's extensive oral history project, we have a very detailed account of what it was like for a close friend to produce one of these panels, which is worth quoting at length. So So in this quote, Russell, the interviewee, tells Rickard about how and why he produced a panel for his friend Sandy, who he suggests was the first woman to have such a panel made for him, for her in Britain. So he says, not long after Sandy's death, I was talking with some friends at Pennine AIDS Link, which is in Bradford. Pal, it's called. Nice nickname, Pal. And this friend was telling me about this thing called the Names Project UK, which is a massive quilt, and it's dedicated to people that have died from AIDS-related illnesses. And it's made by partners, friends, and carers, and they suggested that I should make a panel for Sandy. First I said no, but then I thought about it and thought, yeah, why not? So I got in touch with them in Edinburgh, where the quilt's based, and I spoke to this lovely guy, really lovely guy called Alistair, and he told me all about it, and then sent me all the details, and I went out and bought a great big white sheet, because white, Sandy, was her colour. Lots of stencil colours and red ribbons, you know, the daft things. And I sat there and I stitched all the edges all the way around this piece of cotton sheet, which is 6 foot long by 3 foot six wide. Then I got these stencils and I put Sandy's name on it in pencil first, then her date of birth, then the date she died, then a poem which I wrote, then underneath, all my love, then my name. Then I stitched on all these red ribbons and drew on some red roses, like the one I've got on my arm, which was for Sandy, because every time I look at it, I know it's for Sandy, and she's going to look at it. I know she's looking at it. Then I got these colours, pencils, stencils and things, and every different letter was a different colour, because Sandy loved colours. And I cried a lot, and I broke down a lot, but I still did it. So the emotional labour involved in this production is clear to see, and in this quote, Russell goes on for considerably longer than this. This is just one bit of part of the interview in which he's much slower than the way I've read it, and he's kind of basically weeping all the way through. The detailed production of this quilt would have taken Russell hours, if not days, to produce, but it's patently obvious that the emotional processes involved were more important to Russell than the time it took him. Indeed, Russell went on to tell Rickard that he had found it incredibly difficult to be parted from the panel because it had come to represent Sandy personally to him. So he goes on to say, they wanted to take Sandy's panel, which I hadn't been parted from. That was the last thing I had of Sandy, as far as I was concerned. I'd got photographs, but this was the last thing I had of her. They wanted to take the panel to Dundee to show it at a woman's health fair. Men are not allowed. And they asked me politely if I would let her go. And I said yes, so long as they looked after her and cared for her properly. And they said they would, and so they went off with Sandy and the other quilt panels to Dundee. For Russell, the quilt panel had in some ways become Sandy. In part, this is due to the emotional journey which one went on through the creative process of fashioning a quilt panel, as this cartoon seems to suggest. So you end up, the quilt panel for lots of people did become a kind of personal representation, if not an embodiment in a way, of the person on the quilt. Now, the deep emotional ties people had to the quilt, both to individual panels and to its entirety, has not gone without note. In her 2011 book, Movement, Knowledge, Emotion, Gay Activism and HIV/AIDS in Australia, Jennifer Power notes that the rituals which emerged around the display of the quilt were similar to those that govern action in a church or a sacred site, and the mood evoked was similar. Indeed, the activist John Campbell, whom we met earlier, recalled this sort of quasi-religious mood around the quilt when it was displayed at the International AIDS Conference in 1993, which he remembered as being completely disastrous. I hated it, just hated it. No one was prepared to do any real direct action. I wanted to cut the quilt down on top of the conference organisers, and people were going, oh, we couldn't possibly do that. And I was like, why not? What's so sacred about the quilt, you know? What is so sacred about the quilt? So though it frustrated Campbell's activist potential in Berlin, clearly there was something sacred about the quilt. As a site which memorialised people who had died a highly stigmatised death, often at a very young age, the Names Memorial Quilt took on a highly valued status as an object of emotional and of spiritual value. Some of these quilts, however, were perhaps more spiritual than others. Some religious groups which emerged to provide support for people with HIV/AIDS starting from a position of faith, adopted these methods of memorialisation. For example, founded in 1988, the Catholic AIDS Link began to encourage its bereaved members to produce quilt panels of their own. In recent years, the Cal quilt has been on display in Catholic chapels to encourage discussion and reflection during World AIDS Day, December the 1st. And during these displays, which are organised by CAPS, Catholics for AIDS Prevention and Support, which is what Cal has become now, the accompanying information that they provided explained that the Cal quilt was inspired by the Names Project and that, quote, This quilt has been made by friends, lovers, and family members of adults and children who have died of AIDS. Loved ones are here remembered with deeply personal items and words. So the result, as we can see, is a comparatively small quilt surrounded by the Pieta, which is the traditional sort of Catholic icon of the Virgin Mary cradling Jesus in her arms. And interestingly, this design of the Pieta was created by the mother of one of the co-founders of the Catholic AIDS Link. So there's some really interesting echoes of this icon going through to the group. So surrounding the Pieta, the cowl quilt, surrounding the Pieta, the traditional Catholic icon, there are 15 quilt panels. On closer inspection, we can see that unlike most of the Names Project quilt panels, which followed the model which Russell had explained of there being one panel to one person, generally, not always, but generally, most of the cowl panels here include multiple names. The one in the top left-hand corner, I don't know if you can see, for example, records the following names and dates of death. Mark, November 92, David, November 90, John, November 92, and Mary, November 92. And of the names I can make out from the couple of images I have of the quilt, the 15 panels document at least 22 names. Particularly arresting, I think, is the utmost central panel, the one with the teddy bear attached to it, which records the name Burain, who died only 1 year and 5 months old. Other panels pack their emotional punch on closer reading of the small, often quite unclear script, which, if you can see, maybe it appears to have often been done with a marker pen rather than sewn on, as other panels would have been. So the panel, small panel, which shows a Christmas tree with a red age ribbon at its centre, this one just here, memorialises Anna, who died in May 1990, and its accompanying message is simply, "Love, Mum." This is not the only form of memorialisation which the Catholic AIDS Link employed during this period. Also held in its private archive is the Catholic AIDS Link Memorial Book. Objects like this would not have been out of place in Catholic churches and cathedrals during the period. In the Liverpool Metropolitan Catholic Cathedral, for example, one of the now 18 volumes of the Golden Book, a book memorialising members of the cathedral's community, has been on display in its Chapel of Remembrance since 1984. The Catholic AIDS Link Memorial Book itself has been on display in Catholic churches and cathedrals, especially in the run-up to World AIDS Day, as I've suggested. So the book was also a large investment of time, energy, and emotional labour. The names of CAL members, or their relatives, lovers, friends, were carefully inscribed, as you can see, in calligraphy handwriting. And initially, that process of actually inscribing the name was performed by an order of women religious, the Poor Clare Nuns, until their order became totally depleted membership, part of the wider vocational crisis in the church. At which point the responsibility was taken on by an eremitic monk in Norfolk. As you can see from the image, a great many of these deaths occurred in close proximity to each other. The book and the quilt together suggest that 1992 was a particularly heavy year of losses in and around the Catholic AIDS Link. So these objects allow us to see a particular emotional history of the epidemic. They start to suggest to us the ways in which religious groups harnessed pre-existing structures of faith, language, and particularly of emotion to commemorate and memorialise people whom the virus had claimed. Moreover, we start to see that where these objects were displayed and how they were physically engaged with held stark emotional significance for the people who interacted with them thus. These were objects through which people could start to memorialise their loved ones in a religiously meaningful and a public way. And as I will go on to suggest, these public expressions of loss and memory held a potentially political significance. Okay, so I want to move on to consider now that display, the spectacle of emotions in this history. That is to discuss the fact that these were emotional displays which aired across a variety of forms, crucially in public. This is, after all, as I've been informed, the Histories of Emotion in Public Health seminar. Is that right? Yeah? Today, at least, it is. Yeah. And I want to place my emphasis then on emotions and on public in that title. So the public nature of these emotional displays is interesting, I think, because it allows us to see the saliency of them as potentially political acts. In the historical context of the epidemic, there are loads of examples I could go through, such as funerals, often a deeply private occasion, difficult for the historian to access. In many cases, the funerals of people who had died from AIDS-related conditions were recorded and therefore are accessible. In the face of negative press and public attention, and having suffered a highly stigmatised death, many funerals took on a politically defiant and celebratory tone. And so I want to suggest that we might start to think about them as a kind of tentative form of political funeral. AIDS activists in America took part in a far more radical form of political funeral. ACT UP chapters, particularly those in New York and in Chicago, began to use the ashes of their fallen comrades in their protest against the US government's slow response to the epidemic. 1992 saw the first ACT UP political funeral, where the ashes of members of ACT UP who had died of AIDS-related conditions were marched to the White House and thrown in protest over the fence. To the best of my knowledge, and I should stress that this research is ongoing, it's not by no means final, to the best of my knowledge, HIV/AIDS activists in Britain did not mimic their American counterparts in this particular way. Rather, as I want to go on to talk about, the celebratory and life-affirming tone of many of these funerals and other events is what marks them out as politically defiant in this context. Several oral history interviewees, for example, have commented on the funerals of gay men which were held at the AIDS Centre, the London Lighthouse. Coffins were sometimes covered in chicken wire through which flowers would be individually threaded until the blooms completely eclipsed the coffin. In some cases, simply acknowledging that a person had died from an AIDS-related illness was an act of defiance which can be read against the political grain. One of my interviewees, Miriam, for example, recalled the funeral of her cousin Barry, who had died from complications relating to AIDS in 1985. Now, she recalls this. I'm going to try and play you this because it's the only bit of actual someone's voice that we can muster from this. So we'll see if this works. It's really short, don't worry.
Barry's dad, when he was so ill, evidently, you know, very ill, seriously ill, and not going to kind of get better, likely, as not, that he just told everybody that he had cancer. And in fact, even at the funeral, because I remember having a little bit of a flip out, the collection on the day was for the helicopter service, I don't know, whatever it was, or something random. And I remember, you know, turning to my parents very indignantly and kind of going, well, this is bloody ridiculous. At that.
Was that audible for everybody? Yeah, okay. Sorry about the squeaking. So Miriam's not an isolated case. Malcolm Johnson, who had been active and a leading member of the lesbian and gay Christian movement, and who took dozens, maybe even hundreds of funerals of people who had died because he was a priest in central London during the 80s and 90s, recalled a similar trait when he told me that one parish priest, he died actually, he never told the congregation, he didn't retire, he said he'd got cancer. These recollections speak to what the wider forces of stigma, shame and fear, which kept many people from being open about their HIV status, and which engendered these displays of posthumous secrecy at funerals. A number of forces were at work in anchoring such a culture. Though the UK government was comparatively quick to release public health information about the epidemic, as we have seen, it did so through a campaign that was in many ways undergirded by fear and which engendered a culture of hysteria. And these cultures around HIV, hysteric cultures around HIV, were evident during the late 20th century. In May 1987, 11,000 Church of England clergymen received advice on HIV/AIDS from the Archbishops of Canterbury and York, which aimed to reassure clergy and congregations that fear among some people that sharing the common cup might be a possible means of infection were groundless. And this had been such a fear present in church circles that this information was given to these 11,000 priests in their pay packet so they wouldn't miss it and fail to pass it on. Whilst fears that sharing wine from the chalice during the Eucharist were localised and dissipated before the end of the 1980s, increasing acts of violence against gay men and people with AIDS spoke to a wider culture of hatred and fear towards both groups. As a section of Alan Butler's excellent but as yet unpublished PhD notes, the murder of a 64-year-old gay man, Terry Sweet, in Plymouth Central Park in November 1995, was met with a flurry of homophobic graffiti, including this mock-up we can see of a chalk outline with the accompanying words, "Please step over spilt AIDS." A hostile culture such as this forced many people with HIV/AIDS to fear being publicly identified as such. It also prompted an activist response. AIDS activist groups began to demonstrate publicly with the aims of both disseminating safe sex advice and challenging the stigma around the virus. And I want to use the time I have remaining to discuss one such group who challenged stigma around HIV/AIDS by harnessing the emotional language of celebration and of reverence through parodying the religious spectacle of a canonization. This group is the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. Many may be familiar with the Sisters, perhaps more so from engagement with them on pride marches and other political demonstrations, rather than through any scholarship on them, and this is because there's a very small literature which has dealt with the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. It's only this year that we have seen the emergence of a monograph which studies them in depth. Melissa Wilcox's excellent book, Queer Nuns, has forged a scholarly space with which to engage with the Sisters by arguing that we should take seriously their claim to spiritual agency and interrogate the cultural, political, and spiritual work performed by the orders of Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence across the world. She argues that we should understand the Sisters as performing an act of what she calls serious parody, which she defines as an unusual approach to activism which simultaneously critiques and reclaims cultural traditions in the interests of supporting the lives and political objectives of marginalised groups. So in this case, critiquing generally conceived anti-gay tendencies within the Catholic Church, whilst reclaiming and utilising both its performativity and the supportive and increasingly in this period politicised nature and activist culture, perhaps, of its women religious. Originally founded in San Francisco in 1979 by a group of men, many of whom had emerged from Harry Hayes' radical neo-pagan group, the Radical Fairies, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence spread across America with the central aim of, quote, the promulgation of universal joy and the expiation of stigmatic guilt. From the States, the order was sort of imported to Britain by this industrious member, Mother Ethel Dreads a Flashback. And as this name suggests, the Sisters employ a well-established camp humour to parody the names of Roman Catholic nuns. In 1994, Channel 4 broadcast a short documentary on Out on Tuesday, which followed the London-based order, and they interviewed, among others, Sister Frigidity of the Nocturnal Emission and Sister Bridget Over Troubled Waters. One way in which the Sisters used their highly performative and embodied activism to perpetuate legacies of the people with HIV/AIDS who were facing, as I've said, a highly stigmatised death until the mid-1990s, was to make their own saints. Wilcox has drawn attention to the tendency within North American orders of nuns to create the rank of none of the above, members of the orders who were lost to AIDS-related illnesses. But I want to shift attention to the practice of canonisation, which, whilst practiced internationally, has a very interesting and quite prolific British history, which provides us an opportunity to interrogate the practice quite deeply. It's worth saying it's by no means particular to this historical context that sainthood should be used for what are slightly irreligious reasons. The historian Gareth Atkins reminds us that in 19th century Britain, atheists appropriated the language of hagiography in order to advance their own ideas about what constituted holiness. So among the first saints to be created by the Sisters was Harvey Milk, the first openly gay man elected to public office in America in 1978, the same year in which he and San Francisco Mayor George Moscone were assassinated. Milk was canonised nearly a decade later, in 1987, during a large and highly performative protest against the visit of Pope John Paul II to San Francisco. This protest, which was called the Mass Against Papal Bigotry, with the emphasis being on the word mass, involved several parodic inversions of Roman Catholic practice, ranging from this canonisation of Milk to the offering of condoms to the awaiting crowd on large trays, conjuring images of the communion wafer with its connotations of community and of salvation. Now, Milk's was, as far as I'm aware, the first such canonisation, yet it pertained far more closely to a traditional form of sainthood than those which followed, insofar as he was dead when he was canonised. Sainthoods, especially those bestowed from the British order, were given to the living. Each house has made its own saints, but to date in the UK, these have included the activist Peter Tatchell, the public speaker and lesbian rights campaigner Charlie McLean, the AIDS worker Tony Whitehead, and Ian Campbell Dunn, the man who founded what is now Outright Scotland. But among the first to be canonised in this way in Britain was the filmmaker and artist Derek Jarman. Jarman's was a pertinent choice for the sisters for many reasons. His successful career to this point as an artist and a filmmaker had won him celebrity and a degree of critical acclaim, quite a large degree of critical acclaim. And Jarman was consistently, sometimes militantly, open and positive about being both gay and HIV positive. Famously, Jarman publicly chastised actor Ian McKellen for his accepting a knighthood in 1991, arguing in a Guardian article that McKellen should have rejected the honour in protest of the now infamous Section 28. And indeed, Jarman's 1991 film adaptation of Christopher Marlowe's play Edward II reimagined Edward's army as a group of LGBT and AIDS activists, including here a couple of sisters, in conflict with riot police. So for being unapologetically HIV positive and for advancing the public awareness and image of homosexuality and in the HIV community, Jarman was to become Saint Derek of Dungeness in September 1991. During the sainthood ceremony, one of the presiding sisters would remind the newly enthroned saint that this means fuck all. But Jarman seems to have overlooked this. He was obviously affected by his canonisation, subtitling his memoir A Saint's Testimony and ruminating in it about being the first Kentish saint since Thomas Becket. This gives us some indication of the emotional and political significance of the sainthood ceremony. Though it was parodic and very self-consciously so, the act of enthroning the sort of person whom large swathes of the population were deriding so vehemently, and to revere them, that person as a saint, as holy, as a person to be looked up to and revered, was clearly a deeply effective experience, not least for the newly canonised saint. Indeed, the sainthood ceremony itself worked to establish effective ties and links between the saint, the sisters, and the congregation. These were cooperative, participatory ceremonies. A person, as I've said, generally was not sainted without being part and parcel of the ceremony, and thus had to be alive. The ceremony, and I'll just walk you through some of what it involves to give you a picture. The ceremony began, in this case, with a procession from Jarman's house, Prospect Cottage in Dungeness, to the gardens overlooking the Kentish coast, whilst the sisters, accompanying their saint-to-be, sung their procession hymn to the theme of Rock of Ages, which begins with the words, "We are sisters, male and gay, no more guilt we cry today, no more stigma, no more shame, perpetual indulgence is our aim." Arriving at the altar and throne, Sister Latex gave the welcome, which in the order of service is spelled W-E-L-C-U-M, and then the rituals began in earnest. Parodying a traditional Christian service, there were readings, hymns, and a liturgy, though the liturgical language in this case was not Latin as it would have been in a pre-Vatican II Catholic church, but High Pilari, a variant of the dialect Pilari, which had been developed by queer men in British urban centres in the 19th and early 20th centuries to prevent being overheard talking about certain sexual acts and therefore ending up very likely either being blackmailed or ending up in prison. The sister ceremonies, for example, opened with the words, "Omis and Polonis, bona te vadiu," to which the response of the gathered faithful, and it's worth saying that the public did in fact come to Derek Jarman's first canonisation, their response is, "Te vadiu bona," which simply means, "Ladies and gentlemen, nice to see you," with a response of, "To see you nice," camply invoking the TV personality Bruce Forsyth. Linguists, especially Paul Baker and Ian Lucas, have been interested in the sister's use of High Pilari, especially in its transition from a kind of secret, guarded language through this quasi-religious ceremony to a public one. Indeed, the sisters printed Pilari to English translations on the front of their orders of services to ensure that the gathered faithful, no matter who they were, could understand and follow the proceedings and buy into the shared queer past that the service was imagining. Thus, on varying levels, one could establish an effective tie to the occasion by being included in its linguistic and its historic specificity. Though there are aspects of the ceremony, in which both sisters and the congregation hail the new saint, the crucial moment, perhaps, is the laying on of hands. This tended to be the moment which the newly sainted individual chose as the public image of their canonisation. This is from the sort of colour insert of Jarman's memoir, and Charlene McLean has exactly the same kind of image on her in her kind of PR about her role as a saint. This moment, though, I think was especially significant during Jarman's service, given his HIV status. The tactility of this moment an act which in its very essence celebrated Jarman through physical contact with him, was at once celebratory and politically defiant. Hysterical anxieties about HIV/AIDS and homosexuality had, at this time had, as we've seen, left many people terrified not only about physical contact with people with HIV/AIDS, but also with vessels they had drunk from, and even physical spaces in which they'd inhabited. And we have to only think about the kind of huge press attention that met Princess Diana shaking that hand that we saw at the very beginning of the talk to begin to see the significance of this part of the ceremony. So I argue that we can understand the sainthood ceremony as a politically defiant act and as a form of activism. It was a particularly salient form of defiant politics because of its multifaceted and effective use of emotional language and performance. By celebrating and revering Jarman literally, if parodically, as a saint, the sisters were creating a space in which, and a culture through which, people with HIV/AIDS could access a life-affirming group, language, and culture. So at the risk of it sounding too much like a pun, we might start to think of this as a politically positive culture. A crucial aspect of the ceremony was its emphasis on the future, specifically on living. Rather than employ a language and imagery of martyrdom, which one might start to think about in a sainthood context, by canonising a living person, the sisters were able to emphasise the ability to live, with HIV/AIDS, and to carve out a language and subculture which celebrated rather than which prematurely memorialised. Humour and laughter were key weapons in the sisters' political arsenal here. The humour deployed by the sisters brought attention to the epidemic in a light-hearted way that was manageable for those affected by it. It was a savvy way of lightening the mood of what could otherwise have been a deeply morbid affair. Camp humour also created an imagined queer past as part of the ceremony. As the Polari to English translation suggests, this was not an exclusionary act, but rather one which aimed to embrace and encompass all who attended. The humorous use of camp language in this context was also able to reclaim some of the sex-positive attitude of the Gay Liberation Front and others, which was considered at this point to be under threat from the epidemic and its reactionaries. Now, like other saints, those whom the sisters canonised were expected to perform miracles. At Derek Jarman's first Jubilee in September 1992, the assembled sisters from the Canterbury group of sisters asked their first saint, "What miracles have you performed in your first year as a saint?" Initially laughing it off, Jarman thought for a moment before replying, "Well, here we all are again. That's a miracle." In 1992, the world was nearly 4 years away from highly active antiretroviral therapy, and a diagnosis with the virus was still considered by most to be a death sentence. Thus, for Jarman, this gathering of the sisters and others of his friends, his political and artistic contemporaries, was literally as miraculous as it was possible to conceive. Jarman's miracle neatly demonstrates the unique way in which the sisters married the serious and the silly, the profound and the parodic, in the politically spiritual arena of the sainthood ceremony. This ceremony had become a space in which what we might start to call queer miracles were being celebrated as much as the saint themselves. The miracle of being able to celebrate a first Jubilee, and Jarman was able to celebrate a second and did so before he died, shows the importance of the sisters, shows the importance the sisters placed on themes of legacy creation. In those 2 and a bit years before his death, Jarman would appear in his saintly garb on pride marches and other political demonstrations, acting as a publicly visible reminder of the potential to live positively and defiantly with HIV. I think that the public nature of the sainthood ceremony and the ensuing public spectacle of the saint is crucial to understanding the political saliency of the whole process. And here my thinking has been shaped very much by Lydia Murdoch's work on the 19th century anti-vaccination movement. Anchored in the scholarship of Susan Matt, Peter Stern and Judith Butler, Murdoch's work is important in reminding us that it matters where emotions, particularly those pertaining to health and illness, and indeed death, are displayed. And that the public performance of emotion, which cuts across the grain of the established emotional regime, can be deeply political acts. These sainthood ceremonies established a small queer space which allowed gay men and people living with HIV/AIDS, and in fact HIV-positive women and gay women alike, to shift and escape from a popular discourse which stigmatised them and kept them very much in private, indeed often in hiding, and brought them into a safe public arena which celebrated gay and HIV-positive lives. Revering these lives in public was, in short, a politically defiant act, which allowed people to move from private reflection to public celebration. So, to conclude, what I've tried to do here is to suggest that a closer understanding of public displays of emotion were a vital part of AIDS activism. There are lots of examples I haven't mentioned, like the perhaps obvious ones of sort of kiss-ins and die-ins staged by groups like ACT UP and Outrage through the 1990s. The objects produced by the Catholic AIDS Link, the memorial quilt and book, and the canonisation of Derek Jarman all act as evidence of nuanced and public emotional sources of varying religious natures. They provoke us to think about the emotional work they were doing in opening up spaces for people to commemorate and celebrate against the wider public discourse of shame, stigma and fear. People were being gay-bashed to death as late as 1995 due to associations with the virus, as we've seen, and it is clear that prejudices and fear manifested throughout the late 20th century. AIDS activists of all persuasions, including religious and spiritual ones, were engaged throughout this period in establishing safe and public forums for people living with HIV/AIDS to discuss the virus, reflect upon their condition and those they had lost, and to celebrate their resilience and their lives. The objects and ceremonies explored here have suggested some of the ways these forms of activism played out, and prompts historians of the epidemic to consider the political implications of similar public and emotional sources. Thank you very much. Do I just press stop on this now?
Yeah.